Wonder what the unexpected connection between legendary American author F. Scott Fitzgerald and the Hollywood character actor Edward Everett Horton might be? Hi, I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. We explore this relationship and many other hidden in plain sight Tinseltown tales in Hollywood Digs, The Archaeology of Shadows, with its author, Ken Lezebnik. Later in the broadcast, Bart Schneider joins us. You may recall Bart as an author and poet, but he is also the driving force behind Kelly's Cove Press, publisher of Hollywood Digs. So please stay with us. It's a novel idea. Ken Lezebnik is a veteran television writer who also wrote alongside Garrison Keillor for A Prairie Home Companion, including the 2006 Robert Altman film. Lezebnik lives in Studio City, and in his book Hollywood Digs, An Archaeology of Shadows, he creates portraits of people known and unknown to us through shards of evidence and disappearing places whose stories are disappearing as well. Here's my conversation with Ken Lezebnik. Ken, welcome.
Great to be here.
Your book, Hollywood Digs, An Archaeology of Shadows, is this your first book, actually?
It's my first book. I've certainly been a writer for my entire life, but it's the first book I've had published, yeah.
I just want to let our listeners know a little bit about your life as a writer, because it seems like you've had several plays produced and have been screenwriting in the industry for quite some time.
So, and public radio. Let's not forget that.
Oh, tell us about your public radio life.
Well, for many years, I was a writer for Prairie Home Companion, which I trust your listeners know of. And I helped Garrison. I share story credit with Garrison on the movie. And I quickly say, because I always make sure people understand this, that Garrison Keillor is the most prolific person I've ever met in my life. He's an amazing writing machine. And those years that I was contributing to the show, I always say I wrote the 5 minutes of the show that Garrison did, which is quite literally true. And this goes back a ways. This was the early 90s, 89 to 95 or so, before I got too involved with TV, that I was doing that. So I have a very checkered career, but among the stops is public radio.
Interesting. And I'm kind of curious about your life as a playwright as well.
My whole career started in the theater. I've continued to write plays, even though I've been involved in writing TV and film for the last 20 years. I have a wonderful home-based theater, as it were, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I went to college at McAllister College in St. Paul. One of my classmates there was a man named Jack Ruhler, who founded the Mixed Blood Theater. Strange name, but it was one of the first colorblind casting theaters in America. And over the last 40 years, he has remained the artistic director of the Mixed Blood Theater in Minneapolis. And he has produced, I think at this point, I don't know, 8 to 10 of my plays, commissioned most of them. Most recently, 2 years ago, I've written 3 plays around the topic of autism. I have 2 nephews and a niece who are on the spectrum, and it's become something I've been very personally interested in. 2 years ago, the third of those plays, called On the Spectrum, was commissioned and premiered at Mixed Blood Theater, and subsequently had a run in Los Angeles at the Fountain Theater. But my playwriting career has really been, as I say, I have the wonderful good fortune to have this kind of home-based theater that I've worked at for all these years.
And how did you then migrate to Hollywood?
The kind of trajectory was, I was at Mixed Blood in the early 80s and met my wife, and both had this desire to move to New York. And so we moved to New York in 1985 and started an off-Broadway theater company with a group of other actors and folks we had known at the Guthrie and through the acting company. And it was in New York City. And I, you know, did everything imaginable in New York City just to make money, you know, taught and demonstrated cheese products in grocery stores and had this off-Broadway theater and eventually had the great good luck to hear through a friend of mine that Garrison was returning to the air. He had taken a hiatus to move to Denmark and that he was looking for a writer. So I submitted material and started writing for Garrison in New York City, oddly enough. We shared this Minnesota background, but we were both in New York City at the time. And then our son was born. Our oldest son was born in 1990. And at that point, I had two brothers who were writing for television in Los Angeles. And we would move. We would visit them in L.A., and they had yards and houses. And we were living in a one-room apartment on Christopher Street, the fourth floor walk-up. And it just felt like I didn't quite see how we were going to raise a child in New York. And so we moved to Los Angeles, and I have to say it's been very, very good for us. We, you know, I rather, within a couple of years, started writing for one-hour dramas on television, which has been mostly what I've done over the last 20 years. I've also written some screenplays. But that's sort of the trajectory of how I ended up in Los Angeles and ended up with the fascination for Hollywood history, which is reflected in the book.
And the book is a reflection. It strikes me that way. And I want to quote you. You say, "The studio system, for all its madness and manipulation of people's lives, felt like a small town from the inside." And through this series of essays and photographs, I think your book really has an intimacy that brings this industry down to the very human level and the level of relationship, and maybe exposes us to a warmth and humanity that maybe we are not always aware of just in our viewing of television or our watching of shows that are about the industry.
It is a very small town, and even at this point in Hollywood's history, part of what I discovered were these interwoven human lives. And each of the essays was prompted by some shard of evidence that I encountered that I felt was going to be swept away by the sands of history. And so I attempted to capture it. So, and this is very much your point of feeling like it's a small, it used to feel like an even smaller town. In the Sportsman's Lodge Hotel, which is in blocks from where I live in Studio City. Sportsman's Lodge had a kind of storied history. It started in the 20s as a place where people, as odd as this sounds, they had a trout stream. And the idea was you would go and fish for your dinner, and then they would cook it there. And Clark Gable apparently taught his son how to fish at the Sportsman's Lodge. And for many years, they had a Cowboy Hall of Fame because many of the cowboy actors from RKO would come and visit the Sportsman's Lodge. Among those plaques with Randolph Scott and John Wayne was one for Jock Mahoney. And I put together that Jock Mahoney was the father of a woman who was a fellow parent at our school, Princess O'Mahony. And I asked her about her father's life, and she told me this remarkable story about her father's career. And it intertwined, this speaks to that sense, I hope, of what feels very personal about all this, is here's a person that was a fairly major star, but is probably now forgotten by most people. He had come to Los Angeles as a stuntman right after World War II. He was a remarkable, athletic, 6'4", strappingly handsome guy who had grown up in Iowa. He was a superb horseman, a fencer. There was nothing he couldn't do physically. And he started as a stuntman and then graduated to acting in a series of comedy westerns with the Three Stooges, and then eventually got his own TV show, Range Rider, in the 50s. He had married Mrs. Field, who had a daughter, Sally, and then they had Princess. So my friend Princess, Sally Field's half-sister, and remembers living in this large estate in Encino, where he had set up the backyard for all of these things he loved doing. He had a swimming pool to practice his dives into, and he had a barrel mounted on stilts so he could practice his Cooper mounts or these special horse mounts he would do. And then he was cast as the 13th Tarzan, which proved to be this tragic fall for him, literally, because he always did his own stunts, he did two Tarzan movies, the second of which was Tarzan Goes to India. They were filming in Thailand and asked him to leap from a low-flying airplane into a reservoir of water, which he did. No one apparently realized it was infected with human fecal matter. And he caught dengue fever, and within a matter of, while they were filming, within a matter of weeks, lost 40 pounds. And it effectively destroyed his career because he was really a body. He was this person who, you know, lived inside his body and made his career from being strong and good looking. And within 5 years' time, you know, they had lost the house in Encino. They moved to a smaller house. He was reduced to playing one of Catwoman's henchmen on the old Batman TV show. And then Princess remembers the kind of low point. He did a biker movie, and she remembers waking up one night, and he had drunkenly driven his Harley Davidson into their living room, was revving the engine there at midnight, and, you know, divorce soon followed. And all of this is in the way of my fascination, I guess, with what your initial question referred to as the personal and intimate stories of people who live these lives in the industry that are largely forgotten, and yet they have these ongoing ripples. His daughter Sally Field, you know, was romantically involved with Burt Reynolds. Because of Jock, they did this movie called Hooper, which was about a stuntman. It was kind of a pay-on to Jock. Princess, you know, is now a very successful producer and assistant director in Los Angeles. And, you know, she carries this legacy on. So it remains this a town really of people, of these individual stories that I was trying to preserve before they got lost.
And of course, you tell this story in the book of Jacques Mahoney. And I loved the way your essays are, they're presented as freestanding pieces in a way. But there's this threading of the fact that you knew Princess and Sally Field was the stepdaughter, and then you move into talking about the real Gidget. And how did you meet her or come upon knowing the girl? This is the then girl, now woman, who the character was based on.
I had spent a couple of years out at Pepperdine University. I was teaching screenwriting and helping book events for them. And I came across this article, I think in the Malibu Times, that just sort of offhandedly remarked on how every Tuesday and Saturday, Gidget was at Duke's Restaurant in Malibu. And I said, oh my God, goodness, I had not realized Gidget was a real person, which is the story of her life. You know, she said to me, Kathy Koner Zuckerman, the real Gidget, said, people don't know I'm real. And so I just went to Duke's Restaurant and talked to her. And Kathy's incredibly charming and sweet. And over the last 10 years in particular, I think she's had the book reissued, the original novel, and loves going out and talking to people about her story and her experiences as this person who has this iconic doppelganger that is viewed as, oh, Gidget, it's Sandra Dee, it's Sally Field. Sally Field pops up again. It's the original TV show Gidget. But it was based on a real person who is alive, who is well, and is Jewish. And that was the part of the story that kind of fascinated me, was how her father, who wrote the novel, was essentially an Eastern European Jewish intellectual with a PhD in film from the University of Vienna, who ends up writing in the voice of his daughter this iconic novel about a young woman in Malibu in the 50s with all these Moondoggy and the rest of the surfers. And part of, as a writer, I marveled at Frederick Koner, her father's, ability to capture her language and this world that must have been, on one level, extremely alien to him. Although she grew up in there. You know, she grew up there, and these were all of her friends. She had actually approached him with this idea when she was a teenager. She said, well, I've been keeping a diary about my experiences with these surfers. I think I could make a story out of it. And her father said, oh, well, I'll do it for you. And so 3 weeks later, he had written Gidget, and it And it changed their lives. You know, it became this thing that became their life-changing for both of them.
And did she think it was pretty cool at the time?
I think she did, but she also, in a fascinating way, seemed to sort of feel like, oh, well, he did it. Yeah. And she says, I remember seeing it on the LA Times bestseller list right ahead of On the Road. And then it's like she was able to sort of put it behind her. You know, she married a professor and they had kids and she had a whole life that was kind of without reference to the Gidget we knew on film and TV. And I think part of it was she said she remembers seeing the movie and feeling like it didn't ring true. You know, these guys in the movie, the actual surfers were a pretty rough and tumble crowd. And you know, the Hollywood movie version, they were all sort of smoothed out and gentrified, if you will. And so to her, it's like, oh, well, that wasn't how it really was. And then as she's gotten older, I think she wants to reclaim who she is. I think she feels like, well, wait a second, this was me. This was my life. I want to kind of reclaim that. And so she's, as I said, had the book reissued and is now kind of trying to make sure that people know who she is, as well as the iconic Gidget that we all love.
Something else that is threaded through the book is this whole sense of place, of Hollywood is a place forever changing, really. And even the title of your book, The Archaeology of Shadows, evokes that as well, that places that were movie sets or people's homes and where they worked and lived are transformed into bypasses or Starbucks or, you know, whatever. And that I thought was fascinating, that you conveyed your own sense of maybe longing. I don't know how else to put it, of that right here a lot happened, but one might not know it by what exists today.
It's so typical of Los Angeles that we sweep away our history without turning back at all. And I see it in my own neighborhood in very concrete ways. I live in Studio City, this San Fernando Valley suburban kind of place. But within the last, since I even wrote the book, I mean, since I started writing the book a couple of years ago, for instance, I stumbled upon a garage sale on Cantura Street of a woman who was an actress. I didn't know it at the time, named Elizabeth Allen. And you walk into this house and it's kind of a 70s, you know, style kind of, or much earlier, World War II style ranch house. And there are all these headshots of this woman and a picture of Sergio Frankie and she in a Broadway play. And there's a poster of her with Paul Lynde in the Paul Lynde show. And she was kind of a significant actress for her time. Although, with all due respect, I don't think anybody knows her now. And within the last year, I mean, since I made that visit to the garage sale, her home has been torn down and a kind of McMansion built on the site, two McMansions, I think, because they divide up the lots. And it's just typical of Hollywood. The Sportsman's Lodge, where I saw these plaques to Jock Mahoney, has been totally remodeled and all of that gone. You know, Los Angeles, I think, unlike perhaps the Bay Area, has this horrible history of not preserving its past at all. And I do think it relates in part to the nature of filmmaking. You know, part of the nature of filmmaking is you put up a set. The whole point is not that it lasts, but rather you take it down and you create something else. And so I think that's almost like in the DNA of Los Angeles that, well, structures are ephemeral. You know, they come, they go, you put up a set, you strike a set, and then it's all gone. So I think there's something about just the very nature of how people view structure in Los Angeles that's different.
And that's something as indelible as a motion picture or television or photographs. There's still something very ephemeral about everything around it.
That's the irony. Then what is preserved is the shadow. That the shadow in the sense of the film, the image on film, the image in a photograph, that's the permanent thing that remains. after all of the what most of the rest of the world would consider, you know, structural residences or edifices that should last for centuries. What comes out of Los Angeles, the lasting thing tends to be the image.
I'm talking with Ken Lezepnik about his book, Hollywood Digs, An Archaeology of Shadows. Let's take a short break. One of my favorite photographs in the book is of Judy Garland, and let's indulge ourselves with some of her music. And this is one of my favorite songs.
The night is bitter. The stars have lost their glitter. The winds grow colder. Suddenly you're older. And all because of the man that got away. No more his eager call. The writing's on the wall. The dreams you dream have all gone astray. That won you has run off and undone you. That great beginning has seen a final inning. Don't know what happened. It's all a crazy game. Ever since this world began, looking for the man that got away. The man that got away.
You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. Let's return to my conversation with Ken Lezepnik on his book, Hollywood Digs, An Archaeology of Shadows. Later on, we'll be joined by Bart Snyder, publisher of the book. Tell us a little bit about the Hollywood Vault. Your book has a lot of fabulous photographs in it, and we can talk a little bit more about that later on. But the Hollywood Vault, you describe it almost like a science fiction type of place. Tell us a little bit about that as an institution, as a building, and about your experience with it.
The Hollywood Vault is this extraordinary structure. It is like walking into a James Bond world. And I came to know it through my friend Devik Wiener, the son of photographer Lee Wiener. Lee Wiener was a famous and extraordinary photographer who shot everything in the 50s, 60s, 70s, into the 80s. He was a Life magazine photographer, but he was based in Los Angeles, and he shot all the movie stars as well as presidents and athletes. He was just one of those photographers of the mid-20th century that captured the entire world around him. Robinson Jeffers, the poet, he got this extraordinary series of photographs with him. And his son, Devik, a friend of my wife, is how I came to meet him, said, oh, well, come down to the Hollywood Vault where I've stored my father's work and you can look at it. So I drove up to this kind of Bauhaus-looking square white building in Hollywood and drove into the driveway, and suddenly the door to the garage just zips open. And I've never seen a garage door open that quickly. And you drive into this little mini garage that's sparkling. I mean, you could eat off the floors. And then you walk toward this door that's at the corner of the entrance, and both sides kind of fly open. So the entire experience is like you're entering this high security zone, which you are. It's all high security, because what are stored in the Hollywood Vault are both priceless photographs, such as the Lee Wiener, over 400,000 images, 30,000 prints. Lee actually printed out 30,000 of his photographs, which his son has meticulously categorized and cataloged. But negatives are like 400,000 negatives. But also things like music. Barry Manilow's masters are all stored there. Graham Nash, who actually, in addition to being Crosby, Stills, Nash, was very interested in photography and printing of photography, and as I understand it, started this company, Nash Reproductions, I think, that does this incredibly high-quality reproductions of photographs. So you go into the Hollywood Vault, and the actual files, if you will, of materials are in this extremely low-temperature vault setting. So you put on a parka, and they open this door. Again, it's like you push in a code, and the door flies open, and you walk down this little aisle where it's compact storage. So they have these enormous wheels that you turn to manipulate your storage aisle to open up. And then you stand in front of this wall of 30,000 images, all categorized by boxes, you know, everything from Sandy Koufax, Clark Gable, President Kennedy, NFL football, Milton Berle.
Judy Garland.
Judy Garland. He photographed the first tapings of the Judy Garland show. And there's these incredible shots of Judy Garland with Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland by herself.
I think that was my favorite picture in the book.
Oh, it's a great picture.
Of Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney on the set of the Judy Garland show.
And it's this wistful sort of longing portrait of these two people. And what's one of the kind of amazing things, I don't even know if I mentioned in the book, but when I thought back, I thought, all right, Wizard of Oz and the Andy Hardy series, 1939, 1940, this is not that much later. It's 23 years later. It would be the equivalent of us going back to, well, not even that long, what, 1990?
Mm-hmm.
Like if you said, oh, let's go back to who was a star in 1990?
No, you do talk about it in the book in just those terms of it really wasn't that long between 1939.
And 62.
But you could see almost in that picture where they had traveled in their lives.
Yeah, yeah. And I had the great opportunity to speak with George Schlatter, who was the producer of the Judy Garland show, and had remarkable stories about Judy Garland as this larger-than-life figure and the pressures on her to have that show work. And the very first taping, what Lee Wiener remembered, was they were ready to start the taping, and they had a camera cable that broke, and all of a sudden they had to hold for like 45 minutes. And Mickey Rooney spontaneously stood up on stage. He donned like a headset and turned it all up so it looked like he was a Martian, and just did like 45 minutes of silly comedy. And as George Schlatter said, what he was really doing was calming Judy Garland down. It was this tremendous act of love to just spontaneously make everybody laugh and be silly and goofy, and it gave her the freedom to relax and do a great show. Yeah, that shot of Judy and Mickey together are sort of embodied in it is this sense of the children that we came to love them initially as, and now here they were adults trying to make their way through careers that had, you know, taken many different turns and twists and stumbles. And really, it's almost like she's looking at impending mortality. She only died, I don't know, 6 or 7 years later.
Yeah. And he just died this year,
yes.
I think. And that touches a little bit on something I see through the book as well, is this reflection on fame and on success and failure, and what that means in Hollywood terms. And you personalize it with an essay on your own experience working as a television writer. And also there was, in contrast, but not stark contrast, the screenwriter, television writer Mel Shavelson.
Shableson,
who was known and prolific, but unknown in his achievements to most of us. Talk a little bit about that and maybe bring in your own experience working in the industry that seems to discard people and memories and snip-snip in a way.
Writers have a very particular experience with lasting fame, if you will, in Hollywood, as opposed to those people in front of the camera. Mel Shableson, I stumbled into his garage sale, his estate sale, and had not realized whose home I was in until I saw his headshot and then also a binder that was notes for a potential screenplay he was working on. And Mel Shableson, to me, is this fascinating figure of somebody who was immensely successful during his lifetime. He was the president of the Writers Guild of America. He wrote for Bob Hope. He wrote movies, the most successful, which was The Seven Little Foys. He wrote novels. And even and the Writers Guild Library is named the Shableson Webb Library. But today you'd be really hard-pressed outside the Writers Guild to find Americans, the general public, who would know who he was. And it's in particular the plight of the comedy writer, I think, because the comedy writers typically write for a star, like Bob Hope in his case, who accrues all of the fame, and the fame kind of sticks to that person, and people ascribe the wit to that person. I included this anecdote in my friend Lloyd Schwartz. His father was Sherwood Schwartz, who was another kind of legendary comedy writer. He created Gilligan's Island and The Brady Bunch. But early on in his career, he had been writing for, well, initially for Bob Hope, but also for The Red Skelton Show. And Sherwood Schwartz's own father refused to believe that these jokes weren't just spontaneously coming out of the mouth of the comedians. He thought, and Sherwood tried to convince him and showed him scripts, but it was so hard to imagine that these were written for people because they seemed to own these jokes so intimately. So on one level, there's this tension of the writer's ephemeral nature in Hollywood. We don't leave behind novels. Or in the case, I cite the case of Ben Hecht, who is this colossal screenwriter and wrote some of the greatest, well, he wrote a ton of things. He wrote 60 screenplays, you know, His Gal Friday, The Front Page, On the 20th Century, all of which he viewed as quick work that he never spent more than 6 or 8 weeks doing. They were all brilliant. His real life work, he felt, were his novels. And he said, if my novels are like orphans in a closet, if they aren't read, they die. And the sad truth is all around the world, I think people every day watch his great films, and nobody reads his novels anymore. In my own case, you mentioned the one chapter which I was very hesitant to write and sort of make public, if you will, was my disastrous experience writing and getting fired from this TV show called Providence. And I felt very uneasy about writing about it, in part because I worried, oh, this will look like whiny loser, or because, more importantly, in Hollywood, no one ever acknowledges failure. I attribute this to why we use the word project instead of a script, because when you complete writing a script and you say, this is it, the script is done, then it can be judged and it can be said, oh, well, this script is terrible, it's done, you know, it has no future. If instead you say, well, I'm working on a project. A project is like a housing project. It continues moving forward. It can get changed. It can get, the architecture can get rearranged. Stars can get attached. Directors can get attached and fall away. It never really dies. You never have failure with the project. You're just always working on it and trying to push it to success. So failure in Hollywood is this great unspoken thing that nobody ever likes to acknowledge. So I was very nervous about acknowledging my failure to write for a show that should not have been that hard to write for. But in my case, apparently it was. The short version, I guess, would be that the amiable man who ran the show felt I wasn't able to capture the right tone. And this is where the subjective quality of what we do can be maddening. You know, in my mind, the script I turned in was a good script. But whether it was good or not, the criteria is not really about is it a good script. It is, does this capture our show? Is this the way our show would feel to an audience? And if the showrunner and the person who is the TV showrunner, it's the closest thing the modern world has to what a medieval duchy was like, because there's an absolute power to a TV showrunner. And it's always a writer. I think people don't often realize that. Well, maybe they do nowadays, but you know, TV is really a writer's medium. All those credits you see, most of those credits for producer, supervising producer, co-producer, those are all writers. Those are all writer credits. And the person who runs the show has this kind of absolute authority about what goes in terms of stories that the show tells, the final version of the script, the editing of the show, the casting, the budget. Everything about a show is centered in this one person. And because I think there's a great deal of subjectivity in what is quality, your life can kind of hang on this bubble of, does this one person think that what you have is good or good enough to work with or good enough to get enthusiastic about?
And it sounds very much like a sensibility. In the book, you show us the physical page and kind of recapitulate a scene that when I read it, I got it. Mm-hmm. Yet
good. Glad to hear that.
It seemed like it was not, right, in their mind, expressing the show or in the sensibility of the show.
Wasn't the voice of the show. The most satisfying thing to me is I've had many emails now from fellow writer friends who have said, this was exactly my experience. And so it's one of those great things where I apparently was able to write about something honestly that other people, you know, I'm not alone. Other people have had this exact experience and it felt the exact same way to them.
Well, earlier in the book, you also include, you were talking about Samuel Goldwyn ruining the career of a writer simply because he didn't like the way the writer wrote a scene, maybe with a prostitute or something like that. So I see that as writers just trying to do their job. I mean, even Scott Fitzgerald, who you feature in a kind of interesting chapter in the book. I thought it was interesting because of the tie-in with Everett Horton. But the struggle of somebody of his stature as a screenwriter. And so I'm glad you're getting the acknowledgement of others that it's not an uncommon experience.
Yeah. And while I would never compare myself to the quality of F. Scott Fitzgerald, it was fascinating to me that And it was fascinating on a couple of levels. One, because he really tried hard. He tried hard to learn the craft of screenwriting. And his experience convinces me that it is indeed a just different craft. I mean, screenwriting is most certainly writing, but it's a very different craft than writing a novel. What was interesting to me about Fitzgerald's experience was, you know, he made his money writing short stories. And I say this quite literally. Now, for the latter half of the 20s and 30s, his real income was from his short stories. His books were largely out of print, and the royalties were very, very minimal. And somebody who wrote those commercial short stories, you would think would have a natural aptitude also for writing screenplays, because the short stories are largely about plot, which is what screenplay is the visualization of a story. And it is much more heavily plot-driven than a novel. So I could understand why, even though The Great Gatsby is made into movies repeatedly, it wouldn't come naturally. Screenplay writing wouldn't come naturally to him. But as I chronicle, he was not, in the end, successful at it. But the chapter I write about, to me, I discovered at one point through reading his correspondence that I unearthed where he – this return address in Encino that seemed baffling to me, knowing the modern day Encino. I thought, what is F. Scott Fitzgerald doing living in Encino? And I finally realized he had rented a cottage on the estate of character actor Everett Horton, best remembered today for playing butlers in the Astaire and Rogers movies. And it seems so appalling to me that this great novelist was reduced to renting a cottage on the estate of the butler that he wanted to write about it. But it's, you know, Edward Everett Horton was a kind of worker in the industry and got the industry and was not the artist that F. Scott Fitzgerald was. But F. Scott Fitzgerald's fame, I like to think, is going to be more long-lasting than Edward Everett Horton's. So again, it's sort of related back to this interesting equation of what history do we actually cling on to from Hollywood and from the film industry? And who is significant? What counts as being significant in this industry? It's very hard to know sometimes.
I don't know that you really come up with any answers. Just maybe revealing some things to us, the reader, that we see when we watch a movie, but we don't know what's behind it, either in the industry or the people. And a good example of that is Mickey Moore, who you devote some time in the book to, who was a child star in the even silent movies, and then emerged as a second unit director. Mickey Moore seemed to be a man of big heart and also an incredible force, a work ethic, and achieved a lot in movies that we have seen, but we don't know about him.
Yes, he's a classic example of someone who is a towering figure within the industry, and yet the general public knows nothing about him. He worked for over 80 years, literally worked in the industry for over 80 years. As you said, he started out as a child actor. As early as, I think, 18 months, his mother got him onto film sets and he was being hired. And he did his first kind of real work as a child actor in these big silent movies, you know, with Mary Pickford. And his big role was in the Cecil B. DeMille King of Kings silent film, where he was kind of one of the stars, and he was a child at the time. And then the talkies came in, and he became an adult, and the roles kind of disappeared for him. And so in the early 30s, he decided to go behind the camera, and he initially approached Cecil B. DeMille about working for him doing props, and he did, and he worked his way up through the prop department and then eventually became an assistant director. In the 50s, now we're into the 50s, where he got a chance to direct his own films, including a couple of Elvis movies. And then he moved on to become a second unit director. And the second unit director is that person who goes off and shoots mostly action sequences in which the stars are doubled. But it gives a movie company a chance to shoot everything all at the same time, while the second unit is off shooting this oftentimes action sequences. And what's really hard about being a second unit director is that you essentially have to fully understand and replicate the director's vision of how this film's going to look. And yet nobody associates you. His kind of claim to glory was he did all of the second unit direction for the Indiana Jones movies. And, you know, that's a very tough job. It has been said that he was the one who came up with the idea for this big chase through the bazaar that was initially just going to be a chase through the desert, but he felt you'd get a heightened sense of action and passage of motion if you were in a crowded bazaar as opposed to an open desert. And he ended his career in 2000, I think it was, shooting 102 Dalmatians second unit work in London. So he'd worked from the 20s through 2000. And as you said, had this incredible work ethic. And yet, outside the industry, you know, who would ever know this person who was so key to making so many great movies? It's, I think, the irony comes, you wouldn't say outside of the dental industry, who would know this great dentist? Because the point of dentistry is not lasting fame. The strange thing about the film industry is, in a way, the point is creating something that will last forever. And theoretically, fame is attached to it. But many of the people who have the most to do with making that object famous are totally unknown.
Well, Ken, first of all, it is a lovely book. And I think for film buffs or not, It's full of good information and stories that are rich and very personal. So thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Ken came to the studio with the book's publisher, Bart Schneider, who is a longtime friend to us here at A Novel Idea. And you may be familiar with him as the author of The Man in the Blizzard and Nameless Dame, his Augie Boyer poetry noir books, or his other novels, Blue Bossa, Secret Love, and Beautiful Inez. Schneider is also the guiding force behind Kelly's Cove Press, an independent publisher of fine books that bring together art and literature of California writers and artists. Let's listen to our conversation. Kelly's Cove Press is the publisher of Hollywood Digs, An Archaeology of Shadows by Ken Lezebnik. And this is just a lovely book to hold and to read. And the photos are lovely, like they could be hanging on a wall. And I think that that is something that Kelly's Cove Press, in particular, the books you've published, they're all very distinctive pieces of work. And so I want you to tell me a little bit about that.
Well, thank you. Since I started this a couple years ago, I've really been drawn to the visual part. As a literary person, it's a strange thing to want to do. But even many years ago when I was running a magazine, a couple different magazines out of Minnesota, I was very interested in the visual layout of what was essentially a tabloid. And we had a tagline at some point: you don't have to be ugly to be taken seriously. And with these books, I'm you know, we've done several monographs now, of two of Richard Diebenkorn, working on a third Diebenkorn book, doing the Oakland painter Squeak Carnwath, is just coming back from the printer. And this was an opportunity to find visuals, and we had a great, I don't know if Ken's talked about Lee Wiener, who was a photographer that we were able to get wonderful Hollywood-based photos that many people had never seen, but they were gorgeous. And so one of the fun things I got to do was to we had, I don't know, how many Lee Wiener photographs do we have in there, Ken?
Over 30, I think.
So I think we have 60 photographs altogether. So I got the fun job of trying to find the rest. And, you know, since we're a small press with no money to spare, how can we find them that we don't have to pay rights for? Because suddenly you realize each photo could cost you a couple hundred dollars. And so the public domain pool is pretty huge. And I'd give a huge assist to the designer I've been working with primarily, who is in Minnesota, who I worked with on the last magazine I did there, Speakeasy, Lynn Phelps. And it's a joy to work with him. He comes up with fresh ideas and loves the challenge and takes direction. I've seen designers who, you know, their design skills are so great that the language becomes secondary. And I want the language to be, you know, this is a book to read, but, and he's very able to do that so that you get both a sense of design and a very readable text.
You worked for a long time in Minnesota, and is that where you two initially met? Was in Minnesota, and
yes.
So you've known each other that long. So what was the genesis then of your collaboration on this particular book?
I was actually down at in Southern California doing something at a college that Pepperdine University, where Ken was working at the time, and Ken had written the F. Scott Fitzgerald Edward Everett Horton essay that's in It's really like a beautiful piece. He had written that for a version of it, earlier version for a magazine, Speakeasy, that I edited. And you know, listening to Ken talk, you've listened to him for a while now. He tells such wonderful stories. He makes these connections. He synthesizes things. And I said, hey, Ken, you come up with 10 more essays like that, and we've got a great book.
And he made it sound so easy. And I said, oh, yeah, sure. And actually, it was a wonderful collaboration, because Bart is a fantastic, inspiring editor. What I found is that all of his ideas were inspiring more writing and better writing. And then he was the one who really, I think, helped crystallize the notion of, seems as though many of these stories start with a physical shard of evidence that takes you on a trail into a history that's about to be lost. So that became kind of the organizing metaphor for me of each essay was, well, what place do I start at that has some tangible evidence that otherwise would just be swept away by history? And sometimes it's a script, like the script from the Dick Powell show. Sometimes it was this plaque, like the plaque of Jock Mahoney, or the garage sale items. But it's Bart's inspiration that really helped make this all possible.
Well, it was one of the most satisfying collaborations I've ever had, in the sense of, I mean, you wrote the book, and that's not to be forgotten, and it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of writing, essay by essay. But wow, I mean, I edited a lot of writers in my time, and here's somebody that actually takes direction and thrives on it. And I think it comes from a long history of working in a collaborative form, either as a playwright, which Ken has done a lot of stage work, and of course, television and screenwriting.
Yeah, there's nothing more collaborative than writing for television, because from the get-go, you pitch a story idea to a group of writers who then modify it. And then you write an outline, which again is the executive producer either likes or doesn't like, or you get notes on from both the writers and the executive producer. And then you start getting notes from the network and the notes from the studio. And then you write a draft. And then you get notes from all of the above, plus the actors, plus the director of the episode. So by the time, I often thought the analogy was partly why network television, I think before the last 10 years in particular, often seemed bland. It's that notion that so many hands touch the rock that it naturally gets smoothed out. Anything that's eccentric or bumps gets smoothed out or explained. One of my things I hate the most about television writing is that everything has to be explained. As again, not in the last 10 years with the kind of advent of cable television and more thoughtful or interesting writing, that's less true. But for many of the years I was working in it, that was part of the process. So just having to respond to one person's notes is great.
And was that an active then process between you?
It was very active. Ken would send me essay by essay as he finished them. And there were certain things, like there's a series of photographs that Lee Wiener took of Samuel Goldwyn's 80th birthday party, and Ken had run it as a curated show at Pepperdine with captions, because nobody knew who some of these people like Milton Berle were anymore. And I said, Ken, the captions maybe work for the show, but I think we need an essay for each of these people, which... I don't know. That must not have been fun to hear that.
Well, it was because I thought, oh, I'm really done with this book. And then Bart had that what ended up being a great idea, that there should be little miniature essays around each photograph. And part of it was like, oh, my gosh, now I've got to figure out what do you say about Frank Sinatra that hasn't already been said.
I was kind of curious about that, too. When you mentioned Frank Sinatra, I saw the pictures and I thought, well, what is... I was curious, and you actually did have a completely something fresh and that really did also come back to the themes of the book.
Well, that was a big challenge. It was a really big challenge. And in the case of Frank Sinatra, I just did a lot of research and came across a real estate ad for his storied home in Calabasas, of all places, called Farallone. And in that case, it offered me a chance to – I suddenly said, oh, yes. I'd forgotten that when I first moved to L.A. from New York, I was used to reading gossip columns in a sort of a guilty pleasure, page six in the New York Post or the gossip columns in the Daily News. And I said, there's no gossip column in the Los Angeles Times. Until after a couple of months, I realized the gossip column of the L.A. Times is the real estate column called Hot Properties, which lists, Demi Moore is selling her Bel Air estate for $21 million because she is broken up with blah, blah, blah. So here was I stumbled across this real estate listing for Frank Sinatra's fabled home in Calabasas. And for those who know Southern California, I was going, Calabasas? This is like this kind of western San Fernando Valley suburb. What was he doing out there? And it was the house where apparently John F. Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe had their tryst, which was like, oh my gosh, they were in Calabasas. I mean, who knew? So that was a wonderful little chance for me to talk about real estate in Los Angeles and then this extraordinary home and to quote at length the actual real estate listing, which I sort of love the purple prose of real estate listings anyway. I'm talking about guilty pleasures.
And what was your experience when you got in touch with the realtor?
Thanks to Bart and the copy editor, who was very scrupulous about correctly attributing things and printing things with permission, I tracked down the realtor who had run the ad, and she was very happy because I think very happy that somebody had taken notice of her property
and her purple prose.
And her purple prose. I don't think she fully realized the enjoyment I got out of the way she described this, estate in Calabasas.
I bet she had a lot of good stories.
There would be actually a whole new book in the real estate of the stars.
Whoa. I don't know if I want to touch it.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in, and it's a beautiful book, Hollywood Digs, An Archaeology of Shadows. Ken Lebesnik and Bart Schneider, thanks. Thanks to Ken Lebesnik and Bart Schneider. You can hear an expanded version of our conversation with Ken telling some pretty good stories on our podcast at krcb.org. And you can also subscribe to them there and listen on iTunes. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight. Rosemary Manchester will return next month. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening. It's a Novel Idea.